Kading reports.
The Wisconsin Native Vote Initiative hopes to draw more than 1,000 people from the state's 11 tribes to a baseball tailgate next month. The event will be held August 15th before a Milwaukee Brewers game against the Los Angeles Dodgers. Anne Egan-Wakow is an urban organizer with the initiative in Milwaukee. She's also a member of the Menominee Indian Tribe. Egan-Wakow says it's a way to bring communities together while urging them to vote.
Let our people know their voices are heard, that they remember to vote, that they register to vote for the seventh generation, and that means to vote for all generations in the future.
She says they want tribal residents to make their voices heard on issues like health care and environmental protection. Native Americans make up 1% of Wisconsin's population. Organizers want voters to know their vote matters, especially as past presidential elections in the state have been decided by slim margins. I'm Danielle Kading.
And if baseball isn't your thing, how about resball?
I'm not about to give up on the season.
A new film produced by NBA legend LeBron James looks at a Native American high school team's attempts to rebound from a star player's tragic death. Sydney Freeland, who directed the Marvel series Echo, directed this film and co-wrote it with Sterling Harjo of Reservation Dogs fame. The drama stars Cody Lightning, Dallas Goldtooth, and Amber Midthunder, among others. Resball comes to Netflix September 27th. This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull from KLCC in Eugene, Oregon.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, August 8th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Mel Gertov, David Rosenberg, Eric Tegedoff, Suzanne Potter, Mark Moran, and Eric Galatis. The producers Annette Newell and our engineers Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM. K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth up next.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov. I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the week. Here are today's top stories. Escalation and miscalculation. How a big war might happen in the Middle East. Unprecedented prisoner swap between the United States and Russia. And the Venezuelan elections. Still no resolution, but a U.S. decision. First, escalation and miscalculation in the Middle East. 2 weeks ago, newspapers were reporting that Israel and Hezbollah were edging closer to an agreement that would bring their deadly exchanges along the border with Lebanon to a halt. At the same time, however, the rising number of firefights and casualties and the mutual buildup of forces threatened to do the opposite, create a major war, which, as in 2002, caused huge losses for all sides. Now, 2 weeks later, the stakes for all sides are much higher. A Hezbollah rocket attack killed 12 children in a village in the Golan Heights, and Israel responded with an air assault on Beirut that killed Fuad Shukr, a senior Hezbollah commander. At virtually the same time, Israel also carried out the assassination in Tehran of Ismail Haniyeh, a key figure in the Hamas leadership. The odds now heavily favor war over peace. Leaders in Israel, Hamas, Hezbollah, and Iran must reconsider whether their escalations should continue. In short, for each of them, the strategic question is this: should we continue with tit-for-tat actions, accept our losses and continue negotiating a ceasefire, or escalate to repay blood debts? Embedded in these choices are certain military and political realities described in detail by Dexter Filkins in the July 29 issue of The New Yorker. If Israel attacks Hezbollah's huge missile and rocket force, estimated at around 150,000, it would probably not be able to destroy it completely. That would mean following up with a ground invasion. Hezbollah, meantime, could fire thousands of missiles a day into Israel, causing huge losses of life and property. But Israeli strikes would also cause enormous losses for Hezbollah, and an invasion might well destroy much of Lebanon itself. Iran would have to weigh how to support Hezbollah at the great risk of a showdown with the U.S., which just now is bolstering its Middle East air and naval presence just to head off that possibility. All the parties thus have reason to fear a wider war and have said as much. Yet the desire for vengeance runs deep. Israel's government conveyed a wish to avoid a larger war, but also said the assassinations were necessary to repay for the killing of children. Hezbollah and Iran also leaned toward retribution. Hassan Nasrallah, Hezbollah's leader, declared at the funeral of Fuad Shukr, quote, "The enemy and those who are behind the enemy must await our inevitable response. You do not know what red lines you crossed," unquote. Iran's supreme leader, Ali Khamenei, is said to have ordered an attack on Israel, which most likely would come from Hezbollah, but could be directly from Tehran. Observers recall that the last time Iran responded to an Israeli attack in April, which killed several senior revolutionary guards at the Iranian consulate in Damascus, Syria, Iran made its first ever direct attack on Israel. What kind of retaliation any of these parties will make against Israel and how Israel might respond may not be known for a while. But one thing all the parties should consider, but may ignore, is this. They cannot fully control an escalation. It's a phenomenon familiar to students of war. Actions taken defensively by one side, with the aim of deterring the other side from further attacks, are interpreted by the other side to be more threatening, leading to escalation. A former U.S. ambassador to Israel, Thomas R. Nides, put it well, quote, "Neither side really wants a bigger war because they understand the huge damage that it would cause their countries. The problem is that wars are caused by miscalculations, and by trying to deter each other from escalating, they risk making a miscalculation that does the opposite of what they intended," unquote. At bottom, none of the contending parties really seems to want either war or peace. Retribution seems to fit with each of their strategies. That is the latest Middle East tragedy, portending no release of hostages or prisoners, no let-up in the humanitarian disaster in Gaza, and no movement toward a permanent ceasefire and Palestinian statehood. An unprecedented prisoner swap between the United States and Russia. On August 1st, it was announced that the Wall Street Journal journalist Evan Gershkovich and 15 others had been freed from Russian prisons as part of an unprecedented prisoner exchange. For the first time since the fall of the Soviet Union, Moscow freed prominent dissidents as part of a swap. 16 people in all were released from Russian custody. In exchange, 8 people were freed by the West. This complex deal is extraordinary in several respects. First, it took about 2 years to complete. Second, it involves several countries. Third, it is unique in that Russian dissidents were included and allowed to leave. And most impressive, fourth, is the amount of negotiating and bargaining that was required for the various bureaucracies in each country, military, judicial, intelligence, diplomatic, to agree to the deal. Just a few weeks ago, I reported that Gershkovich had been sentenced to 16 years on a trumped-up charge of espionage. Also released were Alsu Kermasheva, a Russian-American editor working for Radio Free Europe. She was sentenced to 6.5 years in a Russian penal colony for, quote, "spreading false information about the Russian army." Also, Paul Whelan, a former Marine who had been in a Russian penal colony since December 2018, charged with espionage. Others released included Russian peace activists and nationals of various countries who had in one way or another crossed paths with Russian security personnel or been accused of possessing drugs. The most prominent in this group is Vladimir Kara-Murza, a journalist, permanent U.S. resident, and Pulitzer Prize winner. He is a major voice for human rights in the manner of Alexei Navalny. He had served time in prison before and had been prepared for a 25-year sentence before the swap announcement. The 8 Russians who were released to Moscow included a Russian security agent who assassinated a Chechen separatist in Germany, drawing praise from Putin, a married couple who spied for Russia in Europe, and a Russian hacker in the U.S. As welcome as these releases are for the families, concerns have been expressed about the implications for current and future detentions of Americans. The obvious one is that such bargaining encourages the Russians to keep detaining U.S. citizens as part of hostage diplomacy. The other concern is that countries that imprison Russians for crimes committed on their territories, such as Germany, which held the assassin, may not appreciate having to give them up in order to facilitate the release of Americans held in Russia. President Biden stressed the importance of alliances in bringing the deal about. Without the cooperation of the Germans, Slovenes, and others, such an intricate deal could not have been worked out, he said. Vice President Kamala Harris is receiving praise for persuading Slovenia to participate in the negotiations. In all, quite a diplomatic feat. Would you believe, however, that Donald Trump called to congratulate, no, not Biden, but Vladimir Putin? Trump obviously couldn't bring himself to congratulate the president who accomplished what Trump never could. The Venezuelan elections, still no resolution, but a U.S. decision. It's clear from the Nicolas Maduro government's reaction that, one, he will not step down despite overwhelming evidence of his defeat, two, he will not provide evidence to support his claim of victory, and three, the U.S. and other governments are not going to let the matter pass. As I mentioned last week, nearly all Latin American government leaders condemned Maduro's position and demanded release of election data. Quote, I want to note that our patience and that of the international community is running out, said White House spokesman John Kirby. It's running out on waiting for the Venezuelan electoral authorities to come clean and release the full detailed data on this election, unquote. Within 24 hours, patience turned to action. The administration announced August 1st that it recognizes Edmundo Gonzalez as president and called for negotiations to form a new government. But both Gonzalez and opposition leader Maria Corina Machado are in hiding, as Maduro's police have been rounding up demonstrators. In other news, China's carbon emissions are leveling off. If global warming is to have any chance of reaching a plateau before heading downward, China's efforts will have much to do with it. The New York Times reports, quote, a recent spate of data from China's government, as well as reports by energy analysts, have provided positive signs that while China's emissions may not decrease significantly, they also may not grow. China's President Xi Jinping had pledged to reach that turning point by 2030, unquote. China has been the leading contributor to carbon emissions since 2006. The biggest reason for this new situation is the changing electricity profile in China, from coal to solar and wind. Coal, however, still accounts for 53% of electricity generation, but that figure for last year represents a considerable reduction. While China's energy picture is changing, consider where we are. Last year alone, says the Times, China installed more solar panels than the United States has in its entire history and connected most of them to its electricity grid. Almost two-thirds of big wind and solar plants under construction globally are in China, unquote. Experts, however, caution that the trend in China may only be temporary, since a good deal of the decline in energy use has been due to the real estate and construction industry collapse. Moreover, China continues to invest heavily in coal. It is by far the world's largest user. China alone accounted for two-thirds of the world's newly operating coal plants last year, says the Times. In 2023, new coal plant construction hit an 8-year high in China. In short, it is not yet time to celebrate. Human trafficking has a new problem, cyber scammers. A Washington Post investigation finds that Chinese criminal gangs operating in remote parts of Southeast Asia have illegally recruited tens of thousands of people, often by kidnapping, to conduct computer scamming. The Post reports that the UN Human Rights Office estimated in a report last August that more than 200,000 people are still being forced to work as scammers in Myanmar, Cambodia, and Laos, the epicenter of this global multi-billion-dollar criminal industry run predominantly by Chinese criminal gangs. The scamming operations, typically conducted on Facebook and other social media, aims at gaining large sums of money. Unbelievable, isn't it, that in this day and age, 200,000 people can be held captive by gangs with no intervention by any authority, no international action to protect against their trafficking, and no apparent ability to stop global cyber scamming. And finally, two more accusations of Trump's corruption that have international implications. The first is that just days before Donald Trump became president in 2017, a state-run Egyptian bank handed over around $10 million in U.S. currency for what apparently was a contribution to his campaign coffers. The payment may have come on orders from Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, probably in expectation of more military aid, which he received. Trump, who once called el-Sisi my favorite dictator, needed to inject much-needed cash into his campaign. But Washington Post investigators say we may never know for sure whether this was an illegal foreign payment or whether Trump illegally pretended that it was his own money when he put the $10 million into the campaign. That's because Trump's Justice Department under William Barr made sure to bury the matter, arguing that there wasn't enough evidence to take action, just as he did in the Russian election interference case. The second accusation has to do with a new book by David K. Johnson, Stop the Steal, which tracks the amount Trump's businesses billed the U.S. government while president, $1.6 billion. This was taxpayers' money, needless to say, that Trump profited from for his personal use. His children, starting with Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump, also profited in the same manner when they journeyed to the Middle East. It's highly unlikely the government will ever be able to recover any of that $1.6 billion. And that's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertov. Thanks for listening and take good care.
Cable News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to Cable News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. Tesla shareholders recently voted overwhelmingly to re-ratify a $48 billion stock option package that the company's board of directors had granted CEO Elon Musk in 2018. The Delaware Court of Chancery had rescinded the deal 5 months earlier. Now, Musk can exercise nearly 304 million options to purchase Tesla shares. William Lozonik is a retired professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts at Lowell and one of the authors of a recent article on Musk's stock option package and its implication for the coming transition to electric vehicles. He spoke with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg. Last night, we shared part one of their conversation. Here's part two.
So it's totally unprecedented. But the article that I wrote with Matt Hopkins, it's on the website of the Institute for New Economic Thinking, points out that this is not a compensation package. It really looks like a compensation package because executives get stock options as compensation. But it actually, he's had three packages, one in 2009, one in 2012, and one in 2018, which were designed to give him control over more shares of Tesla.
Do any other companies operate like this?
No. Okay, well, that's a really good question because it's...
Or is it like comparing the Clinton Foundation with other foundations?
Yeah, okay. There's other ways, we go through this in the article, there's other ways where he could have what we call strategic control, unchallenged, if he had a different shareholding structure. Okay, then one would be dual class shares, which Google now called Alphabet has, and which Facebook Meta has, and the Google went public in 2004, Facebook in 2012. So Tesla was right in between. And one of the reasons, the main reason why they went public with dual class shares, that is shares that gave their founders voting control. So it was really the shares that the founders have, Page and Brin in the case of Google, Zuckerberg in the case of Facebook, have 10 votes for every one votes of the shares that are traded on the market, the other class of shares. In the case of Google, it was the A shares had one vote each, and they're traded on the market. The B shares were c- controlled mainly by the two founders, and they had, let's say, coming around 2012 or so, about something going down toward 50% of the votes, because they were giving more and more shares out to employees for stock options and also for some acquisitions. So actually, at that point, what they did is they created a third class of shares, which have no votes. And that's what they give out to employees. And right now, in a page, the last proxy statement says that they have a 51.7% of the voting power, but that now won't change because they're not issuing any new A shares with votes. And by the way, the reason they changed their name to Alphabet is because of the ABC shares, because they went to that shareholding structure and then they adopt that name, which is something most people probably don't realize. Okay, so Musk was unable to do that back then when they did the initial public offering, because first of all, both Google and Facebook already had billions in revenues and were profitable at the time they went public, so they could do the flotation while saying the founders are going to control the company and unchallenged. Second, they were also household names. So everybody was, Tesla was not a household name in the sense that everybody was using Google or Facebook at those times. So that opportunity, even if they considered it, they probably wouldn't have been able to do the IPO. The market wouldn't have bought it, because it would just be given all this control to a guy who at that point was, you know, maybe a crazy entrepreneur, had not proven himself even with SpaceX. Both those companies almost went bankrupt around 2008, got NASA money, helped keep them going. So he wasn't able to do that. The other way that he could have done it, and this is, if he could have done this even if he hadn't bought Twitter, if he had really looked at the option carefully, and that was to do what Michael Dell did at Dell Computer, and that is take the company private. So Michael Dell, who had founded that company as an 18-year-old in 1984, and then the company became a leader in, you know, computers, personal computers during the internet boom and just after. By around 2003, 2004, those computers were becoming somewhat commodities. There was a point where they actually had Dell leave as a CEO, brought in someone else to try to run the company. He was still the chair of the company. He was still very much involved, had a lot of the shares still. But around 2012 or 2013, Carl Icahn was buying a lot of shares in Dell and was challenging the control of Michael Dell. So Michael Dell said, hell with this. I'm going to find a private equity firm to lend me the money to buy up all the shares in a tender offer and go private, which he did. It was at the exact amount, $23 billion, I forget exactly what it was, but it was a lot of money.
Is Icahn still around, by the way?
Oh, he's still around. He's still around bothering lots of companies. So now Dell, Michael Dell, with Dell off the stock market, he had to deal with his private equity partners, but they gave him, he still had control, basically. And they bought up EMC, a big storage company, VMware, and they came back, and now they're back on the market as a listed company again called Dell Technologies. But they came back on the market as a known company that had gone off the market and had really gone from just having their computer, you know, personal computer commodity things to having much more sophisticated technologies. And he was able to go back on the market with dual class shares. So he has about, I think, 60% voting control. His partner Silver Lake has, I think, 17%. So he's unchallenged. That's where Elon Musk would like to be now. And now he did think of this because it was when he was being hit by all the short sellers, I believe it was August of 2018, I believe, he tweeted out, it was a 9-word tweet that said, I'm going to take the got the funding to take the company private at $525, something like that. He was later charged with security fraud by the Securities Exchange Commission, forced to step down as chair of the company.
So there are some regulations.
Yeah, some regulation, because he basically had kind of roiled the stock market by putting out this tweet without due process, due diligence, you know, whatever the process that should have gone. So he should have gone and said, okay, line up the private equity firm, line up his financing, and then done a tender offer. if he had done the process properly, he might have been able to pull it off. And at that time, the shares were actually pretty cheap relative to what they are now. Of course, if you're going to do that, you want to go and do it not when your shares are sky high, but when you can acquire them more cheaply. But he didn't. So he was very impetuous in this. And then also in the, as he was with the Twitter acquisition, where he kind of tried to take it back afterwards. He had a litigation, tried to get out of the deal. And that also says something about him as a person. I mean, I'm not a psychologist and I don't look at CEOs from that point of view, but we do know their behavior matters because they have making decisions that affect, in his case, 140,000 employees. He had no problem laying off earlier this year, 20,000 employees.
That was from X, right?
Yeah. No, but he did that. Oh, X.
Tesla too?
He about 80% of the employees at X in a year, and it's now worth a lot less money. But at Tesla, because sales were slowing, he just said, okay, let's cut the labor force dramatically. And we have in the article, we talk about how when the head of the division of the supercharger division, which is very important to Tesla's success to have that supercharger network out there, because now you're really trying to sell cars to people who have range anxiety. And are they going to be able to, get the electricity in their cars, recharge their cars as they go on trips or even in the city? He had pushback from the head of that division because he wanted to lay off some of them. He then laid off everybody in the whole division, which seemed like a pretty rash thing to do because a lot of those people had relations with various governments, local governments and state governments, various places to put in these supercharger stations. And so he seems to be acting in a very, very kind of impetuous, rash.
Well, he's fairly young, right? He's going to be
in his early 50s, I think. Yeah.
So you think that's the... what they would say, the impetuous nature of youth.
Yeah, well,
you guys would say he's in his 50s. But.
Yeah. No one would charge him with being a Joe Biden, you know. But he has other characteristics that may be worse, given the power he has. And I think that's important because I think there's no way getting around it. If you're running a company, any company, what we call strategic control, the CEO has to have, and the team around them have to have a lot of power because they have to allocate a lot of money, strategic decisions, decide who to employ, not to employ, how to compete. And, you know, that just doesn't just happen. So the abilities and the incentives of the CEO are extremely important. But often those abilities might be used against the company. The incentives might be used against the company. And so that's the question we're asking about Musk. And one of the things that he, for example, when they took the Delaware court, rescinded this options package from 2018, that was last January, on the grounds that it wasn't done properly. They might actually do it again now that they re-ratified it, but basically when they did that, Musk then saw his voting power go down to about 13%, and he said, if I'm not going to control Tesla in the future, then I'm not going to use Tesla's money to invest in AI and robotics. Basically, I'm going to sabotage the company while I'm in the head, because I'm not going to let someone else take it over the company that I built. You know, you don't want someone like that running a company. Now, one of the points we make, a big point we make, in fact, is that the whole system of who gets to control these companies are corrupt. You know, that we've argued in many contexts, you have to rein in these hedge fund activists who do absolutely nothing. Or these companies, people like Daniel Loeb and William Ackman and Nelson Peltz and Paul Singer and Carl Icahn. But
so, I mean, do the courts and the regulatory agencies really have a handle on this, or is this just
no? So the SEC over time really has, if anything, enabled the hedge fund activists. And there's this notion that anybody who has shares is, and these people portray themselves, they know how to fix a company. They know how to extract a lot of value from a company, and they're not there to fix the company. They're not there to make it competitive in the future. And again, our point of view is, as academics, as citizens, as people looking at how the economy does better for worse and for whom, is How can you ensure that a company that at this point is not easily replaceable, Tesla, actually builds on its competitive advantage and delivers high quality, low cost cars to the market, employs a lot of people in good jobs, builds up the capabilities. If you look at it from a US point, the capabilities in producing electric vehicles, possibly, you know, upstream also batteries, where the US actually does not have its own EV battery producers, which it should have. That's a whole other story of why that's not the case, which has to do a lot with corporate financialization of chemical companies, of companies like Apple. For example, when Apple was doing all these buybacks, it could have been investing in its own rechargeable batteries for all its devices. Rather, it got the devices from a company called Amperex Technologies in China. That now is a company called CATL, which is the biggest EV battery producer in the world. So basically, there's a lot of implications understanding what this was all about, that it was not about, you know, pay. As we said, it's, if CEO pay was sky high before, this is an outer space for Musk, but it is about control. The number of shares and the value of the stock is stuff that he's not going to turn around and sell unless he does another acquisition like Twitter, which he's not going to do. But it's stock that he's holding in order to have control. And the question is, how is he going to use or abuse that control?
That was part two of retired University of Massachusetts economics professor William Lozonik speaking with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg. They discussed Elon Musk's stock option package at Tesla and its implications for the transition to electric vehicles. For KBOO News in Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
Hi, this is Mark Sanford Gross, and when I'm in Portland, I listen to KBOO, KBOO, 90.7 FM, Portland.
KBOO radio station is located in Portland, Oregon, in Multnomah County. We honor the indigenous people whose traditional and ancestral homelands we stand on, the Multnomah Catholic.